For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging.
There is very clear value in PSA testing in the right patient. There's also very clear lack of value in PSA testing in the wrong patient. What we want to do is to find that little subgroup where it's going to make a massive difference to their long-term survival.
It's no secret that the screening for prostate cancer using a PSA test has been an area of controversy for many years. The harms from over-testing and over-treating of prostate cancers that could be actively surveilled are well known, but things are improving. Professor Mark Frydenberg, who you just heard from, has co-authored a new narrative review for the MJA, which discusses modern paradigms for prostate cancer detection and management. Mark is my special guest today. Give us some basic stats about prostate cancer in Australia today. What's the prevalence and what's the survival rate like?
So the prevalence approximately, it obviously depends year on year, but approximately somewhere between 20 to 25,000 men per year get prostate cancer. The most recent statistics have been about 24,000. It's the most common male solid malignancy, and it's the second leading cause of male cancer deaths. So about 27% of all newly diagnosed male cancers per year will be prostate cancer, and about 13% of all male cancer deaths will be related to prostate cancer. Having said that, the survival rates over a five-year period is actually very high. So it's certainly at the moment above 95%. It largely reflects the common biology of a lot of prostate cancers, which is that it's relatively slow growing, so that the impact is often more at the 10, 15-year mark, and generally for those patients with more intermediate to higher risk disease rather than low risk disease. But it is a very common problem, but I suspect that its epidemiology and demographics is largely why it's become controversial. Yes. Because of the fact that there is a large number of men with low-risk disease that don't progress to death, but there is a subgroup of men with very serious disease that do progress to death. And obviously, we need to get that balance right between diagnosing those men with high-risk disease for treatment, but avoiding unnecessary therapies for men with low-risk disease.
Let's talk about PSA testing for a moment, because that's always been controversial in the sense that it can lead to over-diagnosis and over-testing and over-treatment in many ways. Where are we at with PSA testing in terms of who should get it, how often, and what the thresholds are for moving to active treatment?
So I think the current thresholds have largely been based on the European randomized screening study in prostate cancer. Traditionally, in the past, we've always used sort of a cutoff of 4. But I think what became very clear is that there was still quite a large number of men with significant prostate cancers with PSAs just under 4. So the cutoff that was used in the European study was 3. And that was certainly the endorsed guidelines by the NHMRC back in 2016. Equally, the frequency of how often to test has changed slightly as well. Again, the initial screening period, when you look at going back a decade ago, would have been annual. I think most people now, based on the RSPC study, has really recognized that you can probably get away with doing it two-yearly rather than annually. That study also didn't include a DRE, a rectal examination, as part of routine screening, which actually has been a barrier to a lot of men tested because they don't like the examination. Yep. And in the 2016 guidelines by the NHMRC, that was excluded as a routine test. From a point of view of age group, that's remained relatively consistent in the sense that the main recommendation is between the ages 50 to 70. The important information, though, is that it's reasonable to screen men over 70, but it's very clear that they've got to have at least a 7 to 10 year life expectancy, because the studies have clearly shown that there is no benefit in screening if men have a less than 7 to 10 year life expectancy.
Right. Ahead of them. So that would lead to really unnecessary treatments.
Absolutely. The other major concern that we also have is obviously the men that have got family histories. With men with strong family histories, we would certainly recommend that if you've got a strong family history, you do begin the testing at age 45 rather than age 50, because they're a group. Interestingly, there's quite a lot of studies now that have shown that you can use a single PSA at age 40 to 45 as a predictor of future likelihood of developing prostate cancer. So, for example, if you've got a PSA of greater than 1.5 at age 45, that group actually comprises up to 50% of prostate cancer deaths, not diagnoses in the future. So that particular group you need to be monitoring, but equally the vast majority of men, that's only in the top 10%, 5 to 10% of PSAs in that age group. If you've got a reading that's much lower than that, around the median of 0.7 or less, the likelihood of developing cancer even the next 10 years is remote. So you can de-intensify the PSA testing regime compared to that. So I think they're the sort of messages that we want to try and get across, that things have advanced quite a lot with regards to the evidence base around PSA testing.
Great. Do we know what those changes have done for men fronting up for testing and for how we go about then shifting through active surveillance into biopsy, et cetera? Have we cut back on those numbers?
Yeah, well, I think what would be a good way to look at it is if you compare what screening was like back in 2010 versus 2022. So screening in 2010 would basically mean men would turn up to their GPs and they would have a PSA above 4 and get referred to a urologist. There was no triage test. So a PSA nearly always led to a prostate biopsy, many of which were potentially unnecessary. The biopsies carried harms because of the fact that they were predominantly done transrectally, which had at least a 2% severe sepsis rate leading to readmission to hospital. So there were some real harms associated with the biopsies. Cancers were detected and virtually irrespective of the grade of the tumor or the size of the tumor, because we didn't understand the biology as well, led to active therapy. So they went on and had either radiation or surgery with its attendant quality of life potential side effects. So that's really where things stood back in 2010. If you look at the current situation in 2022, it's really very different because there's a number of different triage tests a bit along the way. So first of all, a PSA is done, and we normally encourage our general practice colleagues to actually just repeat the PSA, especially with a percentage-free PSA or a free-to-total ratio, because in about 30% of cases, the PSA will return back to the normal range when you repeat it. And if the free-to-total ratio is greater than 25%, the likelihood of there being cancer is very remote. So you automatically, just by simply repeating the test, are excluding people from even needing to be referred to a urologist. These days, if a patient has a repeat PSA and a ratio that's low, they'd get referred to a urologist generally. And the urologist now, unless there are some very extenuating circumstances, will arrange not only to do a full physical examination, do the rectal examination, but would nearly always arrange a multiparametric MRI of the prostate as a triage tool. And it's obviously the evidence surrounding this is significant, which is why the government has now actually got a rebate for that in selective patients. What the MRI allows us to do is there a lesion? But also it helps us determine the size of the prostate, which allows us to calculate a thing called PSA density, which is the PSA divided by the volume of the prostate. And obviously, if we have a patient with a normal-looking prostate and with what we call a favorable density, which basically means that you can explain the high PSA because of the volume of the prostate, then they don't generally go on and have biopsies at all.
Yeah.
For those patients that have either equivocal or positive lesions, they're the patients that then go on and have biopsies. But now the process of doing the biopsy is a lot safer because it's done transperineally. And then once we've got a diagnosis of prostate cancer, we're now much more careful about looking at the volume of the disease, the grade of the disease. And for patients with small volume, low risk disease or low intermediate risk disease, the general recommendation is actually to do nothing at this stage and to manage it expectantly. So a lot of the harms that came with screening in 2010 have largely been mitigated in 2022, and we've put a lot of barriers in the way to try and make sure patients aren't harmed.
Let's talk a bit more about the MPMRI. My understanding is it not only tells you density and things like that, but it also tells you exactly where to do the biopsy. It's a lot more accurate in that sense.
MRI's been used for prostate cancer probably now even 10 to 15 years. But the problem with it is that it was really the advent of the 3 Tesla machine that made the difference. Prior to that, with lower Tesla range MRIs, the resolution was not quite as good. So with the 3T MRIs, thankfully, that's been around now for about 4 or 5 years, and it's made a very significant difference, because now we'll get a report back, and obviously urologists now are pretty skilled at being able to read them themselves as well. But basically, it will tell you you have a lesion, for example, at the left posterolateral apex, but the rest of the gland looks normal. So we now can actually direct the biopsies at the left posterolateral apex. The important bit is that we know that about 25 to 30% of prostate cancers are actually anterior. And the problem is with the old transrectal biopsies, the needle actually may not have actually even reached the anterior part of the prostate. Now we actually know that that's where the abnormality is. So we actually direct the needles appropriately into that area. So it's very, very useful from a point of view of directing it. And as a result, the grading of the tumors are much more accurate, because you're now actually targeting a lesion, and you can be very confident that what you've got on your sample is actually what the cancer actually is.
Staging of the disease, are we better at it than we were 10 years ago, say?
Yeah, again, staging is definitely improved. Listen, traditionally, we've always used a CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis and a nuclear bone scan. That's always been the mainstay of looking for lymph node and bony metastases. But their sensitivity is extremely poor. And in fact, what we now utilize, and again, this is now Medicare funded in certain circumstances, is a PET scan using prostate-specific membrane antigen, a PET PSMA scan. It is substantially more sensitive and more accurate than a bone scan and the CT scan. And that's been very well shown actually in the landmark study that was actually done here in Australia called the Pro-PSMA study. It very, very clearly showed without any doubt that that PET PSMA scan for intermediate and high-risk disease was definitely better. And two reasons is that it actually demonstrated disease outside the prostate much more accurately, so lymph node and bony metastatic spread. Interestingly, it has shown areas of metastases that we didn't actually even appreciate were even there before, like areas like lung and a few other places, which we always traditionally thought were very rare sites of metastases for prostate cancer, in fact, have been showing up on PET PSMA scans. But the other value that we're finding with it now is that the actual primary lesion itself can be sort of, in a sense, measured using a thing called the standardized uptake value. It's basically the brightness of the avidity within the prostate. And that correlates very well to the grade of the tumor as well. So it's a great double check if you've actually done a biopsy. Let's say there's a slight mismatch. It looked really nasty on an MRI, but the biopsy came back as a relatively low-grade tumor. Actually, doing the PET scan is quite helpful, because it actually will help tell us, is the biopsy picking up everything that we need to pick up, or is it potentially a bit more aggressive than we thought it was, and so on. So the PET PSMA scan, again, a bit like MRI, is really revolutionizing the way we're treating prostate cancer.
Have the recommendations for active surveillance changed?
So the recommendations have changed slightly, in the sense that at the beginning, active surveillance was really only done for small volume Gleason 6 disease. What we now recognize is the fact that probably any volume Gleason 6 is probably reasonably safe to manage with surveillance, because it's biologically relatively inactive. And based on recent guidelines now, even small volume, low intermediate risk disease is probably reasonably safe to be managed with surveillance as well. So if you've got a very small volume Gleason 7, as long as it's a what we call a 3+4 rather than a 4+3, that patient also, at least in the short to medium term, it'd be reasonably safe to manage with surveillance as well. So the guidelines, it's expanding. So I think we're beginning to realize that what we're really trying to find are the people with the higher Gleason 7s and the Gleason 8s and above, because they're the high intermediate and high risk cancers that clearly need active treatment.
Yeah. Question without notice. Should we be calling low grade results, I'm avoiding the word already, should we be calling things that require active surveillance, should we be calling them prostate cancer, or should we be calling them something else?
It's an incredibly topical question at the moment, because obviously as soon as you mention the word cancer, you get an immediate anxiety response from patients and their families. intuitively they think, I've got a malignancy, it's curable, why don't we go ahead and cure it? Not understanding that the evolution of that cancer might be over a 20 or 30 year period and they may never die of that. So there's certainly a lot of push in the urologic world at the moment that we should come up with an alternate name, although exactly which name hasn't really been properly formulated yet. But it's an extremely topical question. I think the other thing that's actually really important is the fact that it also depends a lot on, I guess, the counselling skills of your doctor as well. It's really important. And I think urologists are now actually all very good at it. But to really try and stress to people, there is a biological range of activity. And even though it's called cancer, some of them actually progress over many years. Probably the most powerful thing that I can actually ever tell to my patients is to say that, you know, I always tell them that I'm not going to give them advice that I would not take myself. And I'll actually say, if I had this diagnosis personally, there is not a chance I would actually have any treatment for this. And that actually automatically sort of tends to relax them a little bit to actually understand, because they automatically think that they're coming to a surgeon, they're going to end up with a diagnosis and an operation. And I think it's really powerful when you actually, as a surgeon, say, no, that actually is the wrong thing to you and I wouldn't do it myself.
Yeah. What is focal therapy?
Focal therapy is still an emerging and somewhat experimental treatment. There is, though, however, quite a lot of data that's accumulating on it. So with the advent of MRIs and PET scans, obviously, as we mentioned earlier, we can now localize the disease quite well. The vast majority of prostate cancers are multifocal, so you will actually see it in multiple areas. So even though an MRI might be abnormal in one spot, when you do the biopsies, it's actually in multiple
within
areas
the prostate.
Of the gland. Within the prostate. But occasionally you'll end up with someone with a truly unifocal tumor. So if I use my example before, the MRI was positive at the left postrilateral apex. That's the only site of disease, and every other random systematic biopsy that you've taken elsewhere in the prostate is negative.
Yep.
Okay. You do the PET scan and the PET scan matches that. So the only area of avidity is in that area. So when you've got a truly unifocal prostate cancer, what the aim is that, well, if you can potentially ablate that region of the prostate, could we effectively treat the cancer but minimize the morbidity? Because we're obviously aware that both radiation and surgery carry side effects. With radiation, it's mostly proctitis, cystitis, erectile dysfunction. With surgery, it's incontinence and erectile dysfunction. So there's numerous energy sources that have been trialed around the world. The common ones that are being used in Australia would be irreversible electroporation, which is creating holes in the pores of the membrane and causes cell deaths in that fashion using an electrical current. We've used focal brachytherapy, which is a form of putting brachytherapy radiation seeds just in the tumor. There are people that have used interstitial laser, and there are people that have been using high intensity focused ultrasound. In America, they've also used cryotherapy as well. So there's a lot of different energy sources that have been used, none of which have been clearly shown to be better than any of the others. But one of the things that have been shown is that all of these agents are generally delivered transperineally. So it's a very similar process to doing a biopsy. The recovery is very rapid. Generally, within 1 or 2 days, they're pretty much back to normal again. But the impressive thing is that the incontinence and potency rates definitely appear to be substantially better than some of the traditional treatments. The problem with it is, there's a number of problems, you still have to survey the rest of the prostate, so that there's still quite an intense follow-up for these patients, because you have to still do regular PSAs, do regular MRIs, maybe repeat biopsies. And obviously, if it's unsuccessful, then they might still end up needing to have definitive therapy. And depending on the type of treatment that you have, cost is a factor as well. So, for example, with brachytherapy, that would potentially still be covered under Medicare, but some of the others, like irreversible electroporation, aren't. There's a very growing trend that this actually has a place. And if it does have a place, it's sort of probably in that patient somewhere between surveillance and active therapy, because there's this sort of group in the middle where probably just a bit too big to manage with surveillance, but you sort of feel like it's maybe not quite aggressive enough to be doing radical surgery, for example. So there's this niche group of about about 5 or 10% of patients that might potentially benefit from this. But we still need more data, more research on this, but it's certainly an exciting area to look at.
I'm chatting today with Professor Mark Frydenberg, a urologist specialising in oncology and cancer surgery, about the latest advances in the detection and management of prostate cancer. Mark's co-authored narrative review on the subject is now available on mja.com.au, where it is open access. You can find the full link in the show notes to this podcast. There is also an Insight Plus article on this topic available now, which is free to access. That link is in the show notes as well. Back to our chat. Let's talk about advanced prostate cancer and the novel agents that have come up. What are we looking at now for people with advanced prostate cancer?
That has changed a lot too. And again, it's changed a lot because of PSMA scan. Our staging is a lot better with this. But again, traditionally, if you go back again a decade ago, the only real option that we had for most people was androgen deprivation therapy. So they would be placed on a luteinizing hormone, a releasing hormone agonist, something like Zoladex, Lucrin, those sort of drugs. But what's actually now been identified is that we've got all these what we call novel anti-androgen drugs that are available, and there's now a whole plethora of them that are actually out there. And it started probably now about 5 or 6 years ago that there was a study that actually looked at not only that, but chemotherapy as well. Usually docetaxel was the most potent of them. And the first study, they said, well, if you had high-risk metastatic disease, if you gave chemotherapy together with standard hormone therapy, did you get a better survival outcome than hormone therapy? And then when that failed, adding in chemotherapy afterwards, and upfront chemotherapy with hormone therapy led to quite a substantial improved survival. So then we then got the advent of these new novel anti-androgen medications. So they started doing the same trials using the anti-androgens. And in fact, they found exactly the same survival benefit. So in fact, now it's really become standard of care that if it's possible, you want to intensify standard hormone therapy with an LHRH agonist together with one of these new novel anti-androgens because they're obviously much less toxic than chemotherapy. Sure. And interestingly, a lot of the current trials are actually now looking at triplet therapy where if you've got an extremely high-risk metastatic disease, would it be better to have the standard LHRH agonist together with the novel anti-androgens together with chemotherapy or just... So that's sort of where we've been heading to. The other thing is that, you know, I guess in this era of personalized medicine, things have also improved a bit because we're now looking at people and looking much more seriously about do we actually look for germline mutations, for example, in patients with advanced disease? Because again, if they do need chemotherapy, the patients, for example, with the BRCA2 mutation like breast cancer, those patients actually respond far better to a PARP inhibitor rather than docetaxel. So we're beginning to sort of bring in some personalized medicine within prostate cancer to be able to pinpoint which treatment is actually going to work better for which patient and rather than a one-size-fits-all for everybody. Yeah,
fantastic. What is PSMA-based radioligand therapy?
So this is what we call lutetium theranostics, although there will probably be other agents coming up in the future. We're now staging the disease much better using the antibodies against prostate-specific membrane antigen. So if we can now use that antibody but now attach a sort of a radioactive source to that, which in this case is sort of the lutetium, basically what you're doing is bringing a radioactive source directly to a site of metastatic disease. It led to some spectacular responses in people with really end-stage disease that had failed everything. So they'd failed often multiple lines of hormone therapy, multiple lines of chemotherapy. They had widespread super scans with bony metastatic disease everywhere. And we sometimes saw some incredibly dramatic responses even after 1 or 2 doses of the theranostics. Fantastic. So again, it's certainly finding a place now in patients with advanced disease. And in fact, a lot of the studies now are actually looking at, is there a role for it earlier in the course of the disease? There's a really interesting study that's being done over at Peter Mac at the moment where they're actually even giving the lutetium before patients have radical prostatectomies for high-risk disease. But, you know, there's a whole lot of questions about would there be some advantage to, like we saw, that there's some advantages in using anti-androgens up front with standard hormone therapy. Or, well, the question is, would we potentially be better to combine hormones and upfront lutetium rather than doing it sequentially? Yeah. So there's a lot of unanswered questions with it, but it's a very exciting area. And there's certainly been very exceptional responders to this. So it's certainly something that's really finding a very active place currently in 2022. Terrific. In Australia.
Are there any controversies left in the field?
Oh, listen, there's always going to be controversies with it. I still think, again, trying to personalise the selection of active surveillance, you know, or could we expand it even more than what we are at the moment? For example, genomics and various other things fit into that, I think, is still a bit uncertain. I think that would certainly be, I think those controversies we mentioned before about, you know, with theranostics, could we actually introduce that earlier in the course of the disease? And I think at the moment, there's still a lot of questions about, in a sense, salvage therapies and the timing of them. A lot of the recommendations about, so let's say someone's had radical surgery and they've failed and they've had a PSA failure, the standard of care at this stage would be that you offer them some salvage radiotherapy to the bladder neck. Now, the problem is we now know from the PSMA data that many of the patients actually don't fail actually at the bladder neck. They fail outside of that. Right. So the problem is, do we really need to look at the paradigm of how we actually manage PSA failure after surgery? Because it probably, again, needs to be much more personalised than what it has been in the past. So, no, there's still plenty of questions.
A lot of this technology, a lot of these new novel agents sound really exciting, fantastic. Are you confident that Joe Blow in regional Queensland is going to get the opportunity for those treatments and diagnostics as Jim Blow in Melbourne, for example?
The answer is, I think some of it they probably will, but a lot of it they may not at the moment. I think at the moment, unfortunately, there's a lot of cost-related issues with this. Thankfully, MRI and PET scans now are largely funded by Medicare, but getting good quality MRI and PET scanning, especially in regional Australia, is still difficult. MRI is perhaps a little bit less so, but certainly PET scanning is very, still very restricted. So the problem is that they may not necessarily get access to it, at least at the moment. The other thing is really the cost of the treatments, because at the moment, whilst some of the treatments, like the novel antiandrogen agents, under certain circumstances are covered by the PBS, a lot of the time it isn't. We know that upfront antiandrogens together with hormone therapy, it's proven without a doubt that it improves long-term survival, yet it actually still isn't funded. Right. So the problem is that patients, even whether they're in metropolitan or regional Australia, actually have to self-fund that, which is expensive because it can be anything up to $5,000 or $6,000 a month. So it's a very significant impost on patients. You know, it's not only access in the country, but I think economically, even within metropolitan areas of Australia, there are a lot of people that just can't afford a lot of the treatments that are best practice at the moment. And lutetium theranostics, for example, is also not funded. So that's, you know, up to $10,000 a cycle. Yeah, there's still a lot of things that are unfunded that are really becoming very mainstream in urologic and medical oncology practice.
Let's talk about the message for GPs, Mark, because obviously GPs have a lot of things to keep up with. What would you like to see them telling their male patients about PSA, about testing, and about prognosis?
I would be telling them that first of all, that there is very clear value in PSA testing in the right patient. There's also very clear lack of value in PSA testing in the wrong patient. So it's really important for them to be able to reassure those elderly patients and those patients that have a less than 10-year life expectancy that they're really not, there's clear evidence that they're not going to value. So don't bother doing the testing unless they're symptomatic. But for the patients that are in that correct age group, especially with a family history, but, you know, in that 50 to 75 age group where they're clearly going to benefit, a lot of the harms that had traditionally been associated with prostate cancer screening have largely been mitigated. There's a lot of barriers and triages along the way. If you do have an elevated reading, it doesn't automatically mean that you're going to get a biopsy. And if you do have a biopsy and you do have cancer, it doesn't automatically mean it needs treating. But what we want to do is to find that little subgroup where it's going to make a massive difference to their long-term survival and hopefully would potentially save their lives and reduce the mortality rate of the disease. Certainly be trying to encourage GPs to try and get that message out. I think it was perfectly reasonable going back, you know, 10, 15 years ago to really question the value about whether you do PSA testing. I think because of all of these changes that have happened and a lot of these triages that are put in place, I think it's very hard to justify now that not doing PSA testing is the right thing to do for the average patient yeah. that has a good life expectancy.
And it feels very hopeful.
It is. And I now know that probably of those patients that get referred to me with a high PSA, as opposed to having to biopsy all of them, we might end up only biopsying maybe about a third of them.
Yeah.
You know, there's the rest of them you can reassure. And instead of finding that out of all of my biopsies, maybe only 20 or 30% actually detected cancer, what we're now finding is probably now 80 or 90% are detecting cancer because we're only actually biopsying the ones that look abnormal. But importantly, the MRI is extremely good at picking up the higher grade tumors rather than the lower grade tumors. So if you incorporate MRI in your paradigm, the likelihood of picking up low risk disease that you need to manage with surveillance also automatically drops off because you're actually, so you don't even need to often have the discussion about surveillance because they're not even getting biopsied in
Fantastic.
The first place.
Sounds great.
Well, I think the biggest issue for us a bit at the moment is still, but it's just the frustration that, you know, we had guidelines that the College of GPs were actually, they were part of the panel. In fact, back in 2016, I was on that panel as well. And it was sort of frustrating that all of the major organisations that were on it, it was the Urologic Society, the RadOncs, the MedOncs, the pathologists, everybody all were part of this and it was endorsed by everybody. But yet the College of GPs didn't change their red book to reflect the recommendations even back in 2016. And the world's moved on even from 2016. Yes. We're pushing now that it's very likely to be a review of PSA guidelines over the next year or
Terrific.
So. You know, we'd really just encourage that whatever we come up with, it'd be really helpful to make sure that we've got a commitment from the College yeah. of GPs to say, listen, you know, we're going to do this as a proper evidence-based process and, you know, that they do need to potentially reflect those changes in
yeah.
their red. The only thing I would say is that if you actually look, it's more along the lines of who brings up the topic. The NHMRC guidelines back from 2016 and really most guidelines now really put the onus on the medical professional who has the
yes.
knowledge to actually say when you're seeing your average 50-year-old man for a health check and you're checking their cholesterol and blood pressure and sugars and whatever, to mention, well, we can also do a PSA and explain what that's all about. The Red Book is more saying that there's no obligation to really offer that as a test, but rather to explain it to the risks and benefits to the patients if they bring it up with you. And I think that it's sort of, to me, it's more, it shouldn't really be up to the patients to have to do the homework on this. I think that if they are coming for a routine check to a
yeah.
GP, it would be very reasonable, just like they need to make sure that their sugars are okay
Skin.
And their, you know, and yeah. the other risk factors. But having said that, though, I mean, it's exactly what you said before. I'm fully cognizant of the fact that the average general practitioner has to try and keep up
yeah.
with a lot of different
yeah.
topics. And it's really difficult to be able to incorporate everything into practice. But I'd certainly be trying to encourage general practitioners to sort of just keep prostate health at the forefront because it is a very, very common malignancy and it does kill
exactly
a lot of men.
Exactly so. Mark, thank you for your time.
Fantastic.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell and we'll see you next time.